what do you think has been the worst decision of RBI in the history?
I would say demonetization comes close to decisions, but it wasn't the RBI, it was a decision it was asked to take. The feeling was that if we demonetize, a lot of people will declare a black money.
Exactly.
And we'll get so much more in taxes. Mm-hmm. I don't think it happened at all.
How do we decide who will be on the face of note? In India, we have Mahatma Gandhiji, but there's no one else.
We can't agree on anybody else. You can tamper with the color, you can tamper with the size, but you can't tamper with the face. Because once you pick a face, it becomes very, very controversial.
What is the basic salary of an RBI governor and what are the perks you get?
It used to be 4 lakhs a year.
4 lakhs a year?
The biggest perk is the house. I, you know, did a calculation at one point. If we sold the house, we'd get about 450 crores.
Who do you think was the best finance minister of India?
I think...
Today, we got one of the biggest guests of 2023 on Figuring Out, Dr. Raghuram Rajan, the ex-RBI governor. Matlab, technically, jinke haath mein ek control hota hai ki is country mein kitni currencies aayengi ya nahi aayengi, kitne note naye print honge aur har note pe jinka sign hota tha. That person we got here. It's an honor to have conversation with one of the leading economists in the world and India's ex-RBI governor. We tried to understand from him ki superpower banne ke liye hame chahiye kya hota hai. What does India need in order to become the world leader? How can you and I become a part of this growing economy and actually create a lot of opportunities for ourselves? Why did government ban 2000 rupee note? What does it mean to do demonetization in the country? And RBI ke worst decisions kya hai, best decisions kya hai, in sab ke baare mein baat kari. In all, we have tried to understand a country kaise apne aap ko powerful banati hai and what is the role of a citizen in it. Please try to watch this episode till the end because this is one of the best episodes and one of the most deep episodes we have done on Figuring Out. And. Go subscribe Raj Chamani Clips and Raj Chamani Shorts channel because there we try to bring small clips of this huge podcast to help you become a better leader and understand our country in a better way in just small amount of time. Enjoy the show. Okay. Sir, it's our pleasure. Thank you so much for coming here all the way. And I still can't believe that we have the opportunity to speak to you in just 1.5 years of our journey. So you can see the excitement on my face, right?
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's such a pleasure being here with you.
Thank you. All right. In basic terms, ekdam basic audience ko, can you tell us ki RBI governor ka role kya hota hai? Like RBI governor karta kya hai?
ऑफिस में बैठते हैं और फाइल्स पढ़ते हैं लेकिन बेसिक रोल यह है कि जो मुद्रा है करेंसी यू हैव टू मेंटेन इट्स वैल्यू
ओके
हाउ डू यू मेंटेन इट्स वैल्यू यू इंश्योर वन यू डोंट प्रिंट टू मच ऑफ इट टू यू प्रिंट एज मच एज द इकोनॉमी नीड्स थ्री you try and build confidence over time by keeping inflation low. Because paise ka moolya isliye ghatta hai, kyunki mehngai badhti hai. So you try and keep inflation controlled. And for that, you do a whole bunch of things. You raise interest rates so as to keep people from borrowing too much, from spending too much. So you think of it as a controller. You're trying to control the economy so as to keep the value of money within a narrow range.
So I have two questions on this. Like you said, it's about controlling how much to print so that you can keep an economy growing and in a healthy state, right? How does a country or RBI understand that how many notes to print, how many currency to print, how to regulate it? Like... Yeah. Is there some process in simple, obviously there is, but in simple words, we can understand. How do we decide ki kitna chhapna chahiye note? Koi bhi, kabhi bhi, if, let's say if RBI governor says ki kar do, to can you do it?
No, so you can, lekin ek process hota hai. when we talk about money, it's not just notes. It's also what are called reserves.
Okay.
Reserves are like deposits that the banks hold with the RBI. So when you are talking about expanding the money supply, you can do it in two ways. You can print more notes and you can create more reserves. And typically we do a little bit of both. But the biggest way we expand money is by expanding reserves. Now, what we have is typically an estimate of how much reserve growth we will have in a year. Okay. And we try and stick by that. Now, kabhi kabhi aisa hota hai ki desh mein dollars aa jate hain. And to keep the rupee from depreciating, what we have to do is, buy up the dollars. Okay? And that will mean that we also increase the pace at which we issue reserves. We can go into the details, but it turns out when you buy the dollars, you're buying them from the banks and you're paying them as a central bank with reserves. So their holding of reserves also goes up. And so then you say, acha, we've created more reserves now, we have to slow down in the rest of the year to meet our target. That is how we do it.
Got it. So now in this, let's try to understand, you said dollars coming in. So I have a question, but before that, I have to preset. How do economies grow? That's your one of the first chapters as well, by the way. And like, is economy growing everything to become a superpower?
Right. So this book is aimed at an ordinary audience who's not an economist. So if you want to understand how economies grow, simplest way to understand how economies grow is saying everybody produces more. Jaise aap podcast bana rahe hain. So if you make three podcasts a week rather than one podcast a week, you're producing more.
Yeah.
Hopefully as many people listen to three podcasts as one, but you are creating more supply. And so to the extent that you're doing more, the economy grows. More people think in terms of goods. You're producing more pens, jo aapke haath mein hai,
mics, more clothes.
More mics, more clothes. How do you do that, however? You do that typically in two or three ways. You put more people to work. Rozgari badhti hai, toh you'll produce more. Second, you will have each of those people working more efficiently. They can work more efficiently because they learn how to work better or they use tools, right? So if you don't have this mic and this ability to record and ability to send over the internet, your podcast would be heard by four people in this room. True. That's it. Today, you can reach millions because you have this capital associated with your speech is transformed by the capital to reach so many. So capital is something else which increases productivity. So more labor, more capital, and doing things more cleverly, more efficiently. These are the three ways you increase productivity and you increase GDP growth. Aapne last sawal ye pucha ki superpower ban ke kya karenge? I think there are many notions of superpower. One is you become a developed nation. If we become a developed nation, our per capita GDP is $2,500. Yani ki ek saal mein har aadmi ko $2,500 milte hain as income. For a developed country, it's about $50,000. Yani ki 20 guna. How do we get there? If we get there, if every Indian earns $50,000, we will be, multiply by 1.4 billion Indians, we will be a $75 trillion economy, which is four times the size of the US today.
Yeah.
Right? So if we get there, it's a long way from here to there.
Quick question again. What do you think has been the worst decision of RBI in the history? According to you,
you want to be careful about decisions by the RBI and decisions that the government asks the RBI to take. And sometimes the RBI has to follow the decisions that are, it's asked
of the ruling government, yeah.
In terms of specific decisions, I would say demonetization comes close to decisions, but it wasn't the RBI. It was a decision it was asked to take because it created a lot of hardship for people. But that's in my memory. There are other decisions that the RBI was asked to take at certain times, which, you know, were again, with in consultation with government, devaluing the rupee in the 60s. It was necessary because we were losing foreign exchange, but it did create a fair amount of hardships also for people. The bank nationalizations, again, that was more a government decision than, but RBI sort of was a party to that decision. Those are all, I think, decisions that over time we probably will look back on and say we would have done it differently.
So you talked about demonetization, right? Recently, 2000 ke notes bhi band ho gaye. So 2000 ke notes kyun band hue?
Kyun bane pehle?
Kyun bane aur kyun band hue?
Isliye bane kyunki it was easier to print them.
Okay.
If you have a certain time and government says we want to be able to demonetize as fast as possible. Remember, you were going to demonetize the 500 and 1,000
rupees.
If you're going to demonetize as fast as possible, how can you print enough notes?
Hmm.
By printing a large denomination, right? So, log keh rahe the ki aapne 500 aur 1,000 note aapne band kiya. Aapne kyun 2,000 ke note kyun print kiya?
Hmm.
Isliye print kiya kyunki jaldi se print ho saka. So that's why we printed 2,000.
So instead of printing 400 or 500 notes, you could just print one and that would just make it.
Because they're about the same size and it takes exactly the same amount of work to print the 2,000. Now, why were they removed? I'm less sure of what the rationale was. I mean, it seems like if you did not want 2,000 rupee notes, you could just have, taken them out. They get soiled over time. Don't print any new ones.
Exactly.
You take them out. You don't have to sort of declare an end to them. I don't understand that decision. Maybe the government has a reason.
Okay, so there's no rationale which you can think about?
I can't think of an obvious rationale. It seems to me that even if you want to end it, you don't want any 2,000 rupee notes because you think, again, they're being used for black money purposes. Just don't print anymore.
Hmm.
Because you're not in any way withdrawing them. You're just saying, look, stop using them and I will give you in exchange. It's not like it's not a demonetization like happened in 2016.
So 500,000 ke notes was obvious that was sirf black money evade karne ke liye band hue the. Kyun band kare the? Like, why would you stop it?
I think you can speculate on the various reasons. I think the primary reason for demonetization was always that there was a lot of this money being used to store black money.
Hmm.
Logon ne paise banaye and they didn't want to disclose it to the tax authorities, so they kept it in their basement in the safe, and the easiest way to do it was in 1,000 rupee notes.
Uh-huh.
Because that would take the least space. I mean think, uh-huh, once you're thinking about a lot of money, it takes space also, so keeping it in the highest denomination keeps. And I think that was one of the reasons people had 1,000 rupee notes. But also people had 1,000 rupee notes because they feared medical emergency. Today you go with a medical emergency to a hospital, they won't treat you unless you pay money up front.
Yes.
So if you say credit card, they say we want to, and many people don't have credit cards.
Yeah.
So you have to keep money. Then some housewives were saving without their husband seeing it, again, in large notes because easier to store. So there was a lot of other uses also. Storage, but storage for emergency purposes, storage for... So when the notes were demonetized, I think a lot of this came out. But the clever people who had it in black money found also some ways to bring it back.
Exactly.
And clean it.
Exactly. A lot of people figured out how to do it and how to get it exchanged and multiple things.
Right.
Do you think the whole purpose was not served?
Absolutely. I think the purpose was not served at all. the feeling was that if we demonetize, a lot of people will declare their black money.
Exactly.
And we'll get so much more in taxes.
Mm. That didn't happen.
I don't think it happened at all. In fact, RBI has a number, 99.8% of the money came back without anybody saying, sorry, tax pay karenge.
99.8% money came back.
That point.
point was like, but more than 99%.
More than 99% came back.
As well as good as everything.
As good as everything.
Itna to wo jata wastage rate ho jata like 1% might be
my fear
lost
was,
in transition.
My fear was more than 100% would come back because some of the nakli notes came back and were not counted. But fortunately, we did below 100%.
Well, quick question on this. US has $100 as the highest bill, yeah. Right? Do you think ki bade note hona economy mein achha hota hai ki ganda hota hai? Like, what's the rationale? Ki kuch fark nahi padta?
I think there is an argument ki ये जो बड़े नोट्स हैं वो गलत काम के लिए उपाय इस्तेमाल होते हैं यू नो ब्लैक मनी ड्रग मनी
टेररिज्म एक्टिविटीज एंड सब
टेररिज्म एक्टिविटीज लेस सो वो टेररिस्ट हैज टू पे ऑर्डिनरी पीपल सो ही नीड्स स्मॉलर नोट्स ही कांट पे इन बट जनरली कैपिटल फ्लाइट यू नो ब्लैक मनी स्टोरेज ड्रग मनी इफ समबडी आई थिंक वंस टोल्ड मी दैट if you check for cocaine traces, you can find much more on the $100 note than on smaller notes. Similarly, Europe has a 500 euro note. Switzerland had a 500 Swiss franc note. These are all ones where I think it's more used for storage, typically for storage where you don't want to account for the money. So I think there is a rationale that you don't need it. But I think the best way to do it is by slowly withdrawing these high notes. The problem with the 500,000 rupees is it's being used for transactions.
Exactly.
Because today with all the, with prices where they are, you know, I have a really thick wallet because it's full of 500 rupee notes. If I had 2,000 rupee notes, it'd be a
thinner wallet. Thinner.
And every time you take from the bank, you know, even if you want to do a few days transaction, your wallet fills up. So I think if you think about what is a 1,000 rupee note, it's $12. So it's not that much.
Yeah.
But that said, I mean, the demonetization was what it was.
While you were the governor at that time, you worked with PM Manmohan and you worked with PM Modi, both, right? What were the strengths of both? Like, why couldn't, like, yeah, what do you like about PM Modi and what do you like about PM Manmohan?
I'll be very brief about this because obviously I don't want to talk too much about the personal interactions. I think Prime Minister Manmohan Singh obviously was an economist. He's an economist and is a brilliant one. So he understands everything I'm saying about the economy. And he thinks very much along the lines of what I'm thinking. And I don't have to explain too much on what we need, my job as RBI governor was to explain where we were in the economy and where we need to go. I think Prime Minister Modi is extremely alert and you know, is a quick read. So initially, again, I started by explaining where we were, etc. He asked questions, but he got up to speed. And then the discussions were, you know, after the initial discussions were more on the why are we doing this, why are we doing that, and should we do this and should we do that. But both are, you know, obviously very, very competent
gentlemen. Of course. What's the strength? Like, what do you think is the strength of PM Modi and what was the strength of PM
Well,
Modi?
Now I'm going to step outside RBI because I'm this yeah. is not based on personal. I think he's an extraordinary politician.
PM Modi?
Yeah. I mean, he has a sense of the pulse of the people and he knows what makes them sort of, he knows how to convince people.
Yeah. He's a great persuader.
He's a persuader. He is an extraordinary politician.
He makes people believe. That's so true. Yeah. Like it's you look at him and you read about him and the way everything they've designed, it just makes you believe them much more.
Well, I think he's very persuasive. Now, I think Dr. Manmohan Singh, I think, was extremely insightful into what he thought was needed. Mm. So that was his strength. He was more analytical.
Mm.
But obviously, Dr. Manmohan Singh is not a politician. You know, he was much more...
an economist than a politician.
A technocrat, let me say. A technocrat.
Technocrat, okay.
Technocrat. But I mean, it's not that he wasn't, you know, sometimes you get the sense that technocrat means somebody who is naive. Is not naive by any stretch of imagination. You couldn't have worked in all the positions he worked in so successfully without being really, really able as an administrator. He's an able administrator, including, if you remember, the US-India nuclear deal, which he pulled off. So I think there's a lot in both men.
In your book, there's one chapter which says India's engagement with the world. What is it about?
So what we're trying to say is India has benefited tremendously when it has been open to the world, right? If we want to really sell our goods and services across the world, we have to be part of global supply chains, whether they're service supply chains, whether they're manufacturing supply chains. We need foreign companies to come here and invest in India. We need to be able to sell our goods in the rest of the world. So closing down our economy is a bad idea. Opening up and engaging with the world is the right idea. I think one issue we need to keep also in mind, we are seen as a friendly country relative to, say, China. That is why the world is beating apart to our door. We cannot be seen as an ugly superpower. We cannot exercise our muscles before, you know, our time has come. And even when our time has come, we should be much more careful, because we need to take countries with us rather than antagonize them and say, you shall do this. And I think we have to be, so the Chinese have a term for their ugliness, which is wolf warrior.
Okay.
Because you're flexing your muscles and saying, rest of the world, be scared of us. And that causes a reaction.
Mm.
The US imposes tariffs because they're scared of China.
Yeah.
The countries around China have disputes with them because they're scared of China. There's an Indian term which is now starting to emerge, tiger warrior, that we also have a bunch of people who say, we're going to exercise our might in the rest of the world. First, it's too early. And second, it causes a reaction, right? We don't want that reaction. It's better to be liked, because they open their trade, their goods and services, their universities to us. To be disliked, to be put in the same category as China, would mean we don't get the investment, we don't get the trade, we don't get the people.
Yeah.
How many people want to come to a country which is antagonistic with theirs? So let's be careful about that.
So giving it an example, let's say what we did with Canada recently, like we were too harsh, we should take like a lightened approach.
No matter what the reality on whether Indian agents were involved, Indian government agents were involved in what happened, that's still a matter of debate. But the reaction to Canada saying, you should not try and kill people on our soil, was of huge indignation. And we, you know, to some extent, pushed back much harder than when the US said exactly the same thing. And we were much more cooperative in listening to them. I think the issues are exactly the same. In fact, the people involved are exactly the same. But our two different reactions...
for two different countries.
For two different countries suggest that perhaps we should be thinking, what image are we sending across?
Fair. Do you think the world order is going to change now? Is it coming?
It has to. Yeah. It has to.
The world war, the next world war is coming, do you think that?
I hope not. But I do think we should be prepared for you know, a possibility that, you know, China may act on Taiwan and the Western world will push back. That is a possibility.
Yeah.
I don't think it's, when I talk to Chinese sort of people, they say, no, we're not going there. But who knows what compulsions. I mean, the problem with more authoritarian countries is it's all in the mind of the leader. And you don't know what goes on in the mind of the leader.
So you think the change of order will, like the world order will change?
I think it has to, simply because the rise of China, the rise of India, eventually the rise of Brazil, all these don't have a seat at the table. China has, India doesn't, Brazil doesn't. On the other hand, the UK and France have, because they were the old powers. So there will be have to be a reordering. The other problem, I think, is the UN is so weak.
Yeah.
And so they can't even do, you know, engage in establishing peace, for example, in Gaza. And so we will have to think of how we create a stronger organization for global peace. And the UN at this point is totally emasculated. And which is also tells me that India getting a seat on the Security Council, a permanent seat, you know, it's good for status, but the UN is a dysfunctional organization.
Which other three countries you feel can be like competitors to India in order to get the kind of recognition or the power that we have? Let's say if there's a new world order coming, and right now, who do you think has, what are the top three countries who have a chance to be in this new world order?
Look, I think
China, India.
China is, of course, the US, I think, is not going to be left behind in any way. The US, China, European Union may try and integrate much more and will be seen as more of a country if it goes that way. So China, India, the European Union, the US. But also, I think Indonesia is a country which is very populous, but which is also growing quite fast. That is going to, over time, be a much more important player than it is now. And then you look in other parts of the world, certainly if Brazil, you know, gets its act together. Brazil is an incredibly sort of capable economy. Mexico, because of its proximity to the United States, again, growing fast, but it has a huge problem with the drug issue within. But even in Africa, Nigeria is, I mean, some of my most spectacular students in class have been Nigerian.
Really?
They have really smart people. They have a very capable, but again, they held back by, you know, a government which doesn't work that well. So, I mean, these are all possibilities. There are other countries that are smaller than knocking on the door. Saudi Arabia wants to exercise influence much more than it has at present. So we'll see a change.
Right now, if you have to look at, let's say, a close competitor to India, that'd be only Indonesia.
In terms of population, we are so much bigger than everybody else, right? The only country which is anywhere near our size is China, which is why everybody is looking for India as an alternative to
plus
China.
Plus one,
But I think that if you are willing to go down to 250 million, then you're talking about countries like Indonesia.
And you know, they give, so you talked about Saudi Arabia. I'll just wrap up like last two, three questions because I know you have to leave. But so Saudi Arabia keeps going on and giving the speeches that we are going to be the new Europe of the world. Right. Do you think that'll happen?
They have a lot of money. I don't know how well that money is being spent. I talked a lot with, you know.
Well, they're spending on football for sure.
Well, that's right? The issue, right? China also spent a lot on football, but didn't actually get anywhere. And now they're cutting back on all that spending. I think there's a lot of money available in Saudi Arabia right now, and they're trying to figure out what their path for growth is. But, you know, going back to this book, it all comes down to the quality of your people and your assets. We emphasize, again, we need to make a huge difference in education and healthcare to get many of our people to the level where they can get those spectacular jobs. We talk throughout on how, when we talk to entrepreneurs, again and again in India, they say we don't find people.
Yeah.
When you talk to the Saudis, they want to do many of the industries that we already have a presence in. No? They want to do IT in a big way. But then you have to ask, do they have the human capital to do that IT? And if you're spending, you know, 10, 15 hours a week reading the Quran in school, you're not spending enough time doing math and so on. So they have to change the nature of their curriculum, because there was a lot more emphasis on that in the past. They're thinking of doing that, but that requires a change in your whole government attitude. And I think they're energized about it. But this is basically saying to us, we have a lot of competition also from the rest of the world as they change.
Yeah.
And we'd better change also to really focus on investing in our human capital.
We have cheap labor. Yes. We have a lot of population. Yes. And now we're not seen globally in good lenses. It's not that people see ki, okay, India se to bekar hoga ya kuch hoga, right? Don't you think all of this should reflect that we should have a great manufacturing capabilities around the world? Like, we are not the leaders in manufacturing still, even though we have the largest population, young people, we have a lot of FDI coming in. Yeah. Why do you think like we have still not become the top or become the best in world for manufacturing when we can actually provide the cheapest in the world?
So that's actually a great question, because if you compare sort of India with China, China is there, right? China is the manufacturing workshop to the world. What did we not do?
Exactly.
What did China do? And if you look at the details, there are a few things which hit you very quickly. One, while we have a lot of people, we don't have a lot of well-educated sort of high school graduates. They are often moderately educated. The ones that finish high school and are really good, most of them don't want to work with their hands. They go on to college and to university.
Yeah.
And not all our university graduates are great. I mean, we cite this survey from WeBox, which says only 50% of our university graduates are employable. So one is, in China, the level of education, especially mass education, was higher. And many of those were willing to work with their hands once they left schools. And so the quality of worker you got was very good. Today, when we talk to entrepreneurs in India, they say, we can't find workers.
Yeah.
And that boggles the mind, no? When we have so
highly
much
skilled,
population.
Highly skilled workers.
What they mean is we can't find appropriately skilled workers, right? So we need to work on that. We need to have many more people graduating with decent high school education, but also able and willing to work in factories, right? The factory job also needs to be made better. That's another issue which we need to think about. The second thing is the rules and regulations. We've always talked about the rules and regulations being onerous in India, difficult to set up a factory. I don't know what rules and regulations you have to go through to. Maybe this you didn't have to, because this is relatively services not hit by all the other.
But now we do. Now we have
now
to go
through.
Now you're
bigger, you have all the rules and regulations. So we have to make it much more business friendly.
Hmm.
And that is a problem. In China, what they did is they had the local government, which wanted to encourage growth, because often the local government leader was promoted based on the growth he generated or she generated. Yeah. So they changed the rules to make it easier for the local businesses to actually grow. So that was another thing China did. Third thing China did, which is going to be very hard in our democracy, is they actually suppressed unions. The unions were all departments of the Communist Party, and the Communist Party said, you'll do what we say. They suppressed the unions and they kept wage growth low.
Mm.
So workers were paid less than their productivity, which of course meant that firms were looking to hire a lot of them, and they grew much, much faster. Last thing that that China did was it kept the exchange rate really low. So Chinese goods were seen as really, really productive. And put all these together, they grew their manufacturing. But who paid the price? The price was paid by the Chinese household, because you kept the exchange rate low so they couldn't buy things. Things were much costlier in Chinese in China, because you had to import some of the goods at high cost. They also didn't pay them enough. So Chinese households didn't make a lot of money. So one of the big disparities between China and other countries is you look at the consumption levels, how much households buy and consume as a fraction of GDP, it's really low.
Really?
So, yeah, it's much lower than a country at its level of per capita GDP. So, I think China right now is about 50% consumption to GDP. India's at around 60, 65%. So,
interesting.
If you're willing to pay the price, the Chinese model can work. But it also is not, you know, it did some things which is hard to do in India.
Yeah.
It had a higher level of education that we can work on. But it also had much more decentralization of policy. Mm. We are a much more centralized country. And maybe that model has something for us to learn from, which is decentralization and more suitable rules and regulations. Don't kill the business with too many rules.
Wait, quick question. What do you think? America is a superpower right now. China is another in making. And then India is somewhere there. Like people are banking on India's growth for next 10, 20 years, right? What do you think? One thing, if you have to highlight. What did America do right to grow to where they are today? What did China do right? And what is India doing right?
Okay. So,
just make it interesting. Talk about one thing they did wrong as well.
Okay. I think what the US has done right is kept a relatively open economy, open in many ways, and earlier, a little more willing to give freedom to businesses to grow and not put too many rules and regulations on them. What it also did early on is build fantastic universities, which created the knowledge base that has powered the US economy. I mean, look at all these spectacular companies. Google, where did Google get its intellectual property from? Stanford University. Take all the biotech that's happening around MIT, and you see that even today, it's being powered by the intellectual property it's creating. What China did really effectively was it experimented while setting policy in an attempt to generate growth. They used to have a term, we cross the river by feeling the stones. In other words, we don't put out regulation just like that and, you know, see what happens. We experiment with a certain change here, see if it works, then extend it more widely, right? So, for example, the digital renminbi that they're thinking about, spent a lot of time planning it, then rolled it out in a couple of cities. Now they're thinking of rolling it out more widely.
Nationally, yeah.
Yeah. So that's how they have done policy. And it was very, very, I think, with this decentralized policy changes, which tailored the policy to the needs of a particular area, they were very effective in growing. I also mentioned some of what they did in holding back wages and all that. So they grew spectacularly fast. We were the same per capita GDP as they were in the 1960s. Today, they're 5 times our per capita GDP. So they've done something right. We haven't done anything wrong. We just haven't done anything as spectacular as they have. What has India done right? I would say, you know, certainly what India has done right in some ways is it focused early on higher education, maybe a little too early, but it built at a time when it didn't really need them, spectacular engineering colleges like the IITs, strong management schools like the IIMs. It is now reaping the benefit of all those by producing high-quality students who the rest of the world wants. So that's the source of the services business. It started with the IT business. Remember the 90s, lot of engineers going into IT and creating that business, now a $250 billion business. But it's also migrated into other services like management consulting and so on. So that India did really well. Now, you asked, what did each one do wrong? I think from the US, most recently, I think the US has become much more inward-looking and has become much more protectionist. That, to my mind, and it's also become much more directive in terms of policy. Government is interfering much more.
Yeah.
You know, build this, build that. We're going to subsidize this. We're going to subsidize that. That, I think, is truly against the American spirit.
True.
And that is going to be problematic for them down the line because they found they spent too much on subsidizing chip factories and this and that. The rest of the world may benefit. We'll get cheap chips. But they will have wasted a lot of money. So that's the downside for America. For China, my view is they're turning authoritarian at just the wrong time. Because for China, it's reached near the frontiers of growth. It used to be in catch-up growth, where it used to learn or steal ideas from the rest of the world and grow. But now it's reached near the frontier in many areas, EVs, drones, even AI. And so further growth requires them to innovate. And they're building out very strong universities. They can innovate. But the government is turning much more authoritarian. And innovation and creativity doesn't happen in an environment
which is so closed.
Which is closed, right? You need the freedom to do anything, to create an irreverent podcast that people listen to. And that is going to make a difference if you are too directive. So, for example, recently they shut down all tutoring services, internet tutoring services, because they were helping rich kids. And said, no, everybody has to be helped because you're giving an additional advantage to rich kids. You cannot have tutoring services that you charge for.
Really?
So that's the kind of government intervention which hurts their economic growth. From India's perspective, I think the mistake we're making is we're not recognizing that our strongest capability is in the area of services. And that services means a lot of things. It can mean high quality jobs. It can mean even low quality, low skilled jobs. For example, you know, a waiter is providing a service. If we expand the number of restaurants in this country, we will be creating a large number of jobs. If we expand tourism, today we get fewer tourists than Singapore. You know, if we expand the number of tourists, we will have a huge tourist industry, which can create a lot of low-skilled jobs, employing people from agriculture. So I think we need to be open to what has worked in this country and emphasize that rather than impose a vision of where we want the country to go, which unfortunately I think tends to overemphasize manufacturing, which is sort of the past rather than things like what you're doing. I mean, who would imagine a few years ago that you'd have a service which is reaching millions?
Yeah.
And it's a valuable service.
Yep. Well, you know, on all three of them, I want to add something because I was reading a while ago where for America, Elon Musk said the same thing. He said that America was always a nation of risk takers. And now it's turning into a nation of regulators. So America needs more risk takers, less regulators, not the otherwise, like not the vice versa. And that's exactly what you just mentioned as well. Then with China, one of the billionaires from China now moved to US, said the same thing anonymously on a podcast. And he just talked about this, that now the government, the central authorities, is not able to understand how the young world and the young people need to grow. Like, it was great at one point where they closed everything and they let Chinese economy flourish. And that's why they are successful as well, because they didn't let other competitors come in. But now it's not going to work because you are not the second or the third or the fourth now. You are the first. And for first, you need that freedom of expression and freedom of innovation. So that's going to work out. And the third on India, what did you say? You talked about
the turning back the clock.
Tourism and services, right?
Yeah.
And so I was listening to again, I think it was one of the economists or I think someone like just important NRI who was talking about economics. I don't know who. And he said something very beautiful that India has created so much content just like us around the world to tell the world that India has arrived. Mm. So you need to invest.
Mm.
But India failed to deliver content on that you need to visit.
Mm.
Like, India has done a great job in making other people believe that it's India's time and now everybody need to invest in India, need to grow. But they fail to deliver that, hey, you can also visit a beautiful country and that's where the tourism is.
I think that's important. I think as much as, I mean, going back to the idea of soft power, as much as beautiful landscapes and incredible India are advertising, is also the people and the warmth and the love and openness.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important we don't lose that image also, that we don't be seen as a hard country, as a country that is closed, that is not inclusive. We need to be seen as a microcosm of global civilization. We have every race, every religion, every language, all of them reflected in this country. I mean, you have French in Pondicherry.
Yeah.
You have, you know, English in many places. You have tribal dialects of enormous variety. You have various ethnicities, right, in this country. You know, somebody from the Andamans looks quite different from somebody from Ladakh.
Yeah.
It's a huge diversity. And what we're saying is we look like the world. We are the world. Come visit us.
True.
I think that's a great message. We shouldn't lose it.
Okay. Last three quick questions. This is more like rapid fire. But, okay. So number one is, how do we decide who will be on the face of note? Like in America, they keep changing the presidents, right? And in India, we have Mahatma Gandhiji, but there's no one else. So how do we decide who will be on the note?
We can't agree on anybody else. who decides?
Like it's been decided and they just keep going on. Nobody can introduce new thing. Like what's the policy behind it?
I think so. We did design some new notes, but in general, the sense was you can tamper with the color, you can tamper with the size, but you can't tamper with the face. Because once you pick a face, it becomes very, very controversial. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, like the UK, you would bring in sort of scientists, social reformers, you know, prominent historical figures, women. But we need some agreement, right? Mm. Nobody knows what Ashoka looked like. How do you put Ashoka? And then there's controversy about whether, you know, he really committed genocide on the Kalingas or not. So I think with every person in history you pick up, there will be some issue. What is non-controversial is perhaps scientific minds, Homi Bhabha, for example. Perhaps we could bring some of those on the note. There will be a lot of debate on who's more important, who's less important. And then once you open it up, then everybody wants their political leaders on the face. So I think it's maybe just continue with Mahatma Gandhi and bring everybody else out in stamps.
Fair. What is the basic salary of an RBI governor and what are the perks you get?
I don't know what the current salary is. Used to be 4 lakhs a year.
4 lakhs a year?
A year.
Okay.
The biggest perk is the house.
Okay. You get like a really big house?
You get a really big house in a really, a few blocks away from Dhirubhai Ambani's house.
In Mumbai?
In Mumbai on Malabar Hill.
Okay.
You know, did a calculation at one point. If we sold the house, we lease it. We don't. Mm. We have a long-term lease from the Port Authority. We'd get about 450 crores, and then we invest that, and then I could pay the entire top brass of the RBI their salary. and we just move into an apartment there. But it's a splendid house in a very nice.
What are the other perks you get?
You get a car. You get a lot of staff to maintain that house. It's an old house, so it needs maintenance.
You get like a really fancy luxury car, or not? Just like
you get a decent car, but it's not like you can't. You can't in a
get like a Rolls Royce or a Mercedes.
You can't in a poor country do that. You should not do that.
So, but 4 lakh for an RBI government, do you think it's less or it's appropriate or it's more?
It's on par with the you know, secretary. I think it's on par with the cabinet secretary. It's not. It's what government officials get. You don't get the other perks that government officials get. You don't get a pension. But you get, I think, medical facilities.
So post you're retired, you don't get pension?
I don't get a pension.
So what do you do after that? Like you have to restart your career again?
Well,
because with most, 4 lakhs, you're not been able to like save a lot.
Well, the reason partly was most past RBI governors were civil servants.
Hmm.
So they already got a pension from their civil service. But there was one who wasn't, and I won't name him, but I thought it was appropriate that the RBI in that case, because of his many years of service to the RBI and to the government, that he should get a pension. But I think, you know, I don't need a pension. I have a full-time job. So I was young enough to go back to a job. And so that's, it's not my issue. But again, I think the rationale was you have another job before you come into the RBI or you were an RBI official. Actually, only I think 2 RBI officials have been appointed governor. But so you have an independent pension from somewhere.
Got it. And quick question, who do you think was the best finance minister of India and why?
You know, I think there is a tussle, in my view,
okay,
between Dr. Manmohan Singh and Mr. Yashwant Sinha. Yashwant Sinha from the NDA.
Yeah.
Manmohan Singh, of course, from the early Congress.
But why? Like, why? Give me one reason why.
I think Dr. Manmohan Singh did the big liberalization in the early 90s.
92, yeah.
And that was a time of tremendous change. And I think, you know, it took that combination of Dr. Narasimha Rao, who facilitated the political environment, and Dr. Manmohan Singh, who laid out the specific reforms. So I think that was spectacular. And it set the pace for growth subsequently. I think Mr. Yashwant Sinha, especially in the NDA under Vajpayee, Mr. Vajpayee, there was a period when, you know, reforms had been done. The question is, do we need any more?
Mm.
And he kept pushing. He kept saying, we're not done. We need to do more. And, you know, things like simplifying the tax system. He pushed for privatization because he said, you know, we have too much of a, you know, occupy too much position in the state. You know, maybe even privatizing the banks. There are lots of ideas that were put out. Some stuck. Some there was pushed back because, I mean, to some extent, he didn't get the same kind of political support that Dr. Manmohan Singh got. But I thought that there was a very innovative period. And, you know, in terms of just sheer intellect, Mr. Chidambaram is also a finance minister with, who's done, I think, the dream budget during the coalition governments was under his time. But he would be another person who would be in the consideration.
Fair. All right. We recently had a good fortune to speak to Yashwant Sinha's son, Jayant Sinha.
So, Jayant and I went to IIT together.
Oh, we were classmates.
We're classmates.
What was there in that batch? Tell me.
We are friends. We're good friends. We were on the same quiz team for IIT Delhi.
Really?
Actually, Rajdeep Sardesai just told me that they were on the opposing team. Jayant is extraordinary in terms of what he's achieved over time. HBS, McKinsey, Omidyar, lots of
exactly
places.
Everywhere he goes, like just sitting on top.
But these are the kinds of intellects that we need to keep and generate intellectual property from India. A lot of the book is about how do we become a superpower in ideas, in creativity, because for the next 25 years, if we want to become a developed country, our current pace of growth is not enough.
True.
The kinds of jobs we are creating is not enough. We need to become an idea superpower, a creative superpower. And for that, we need to really work from today in making that possible.
100%. And I think that's happening. It's just, I think with conversation like these, we just need to accelerate that more. With the books like these, we need to accelerate that even faster. But it's already happening. The seed has been sown.
Exactly. So the book is all about examples of how Indians are already doing it. How do we multiply that 10, 100, 1,000 times? That's really the question.
Well, question of the day. We have a lot of finance influencers in the world who give finance tips and they're finfluencers, but we want it from the OG. Why don't you give us three finance tips you would want to give to every young person who's watching this?
Well,
it can be personal, or it can be on a broader person.
Two are very obvious, right?
Okay.
One is, it's never too early to start saving.
Okay.
Right? And I'm not saying saving to just, you know, hold it.
Hmm.
You may find the opportunity to start a venture, to become an entrepreneur. Having some money of your own is always useful. Savings give you independence, give you peace of mind.
Yeah.
Spending gives you personal satisfaction, but it also puts you in a greater sense of stress. So spend what you need to, you know, have a good life, but where you can, try and save. And sometimes for young people, there's so many ways of saving. If you just spend a little more time researching certain, you know, products or certain things, do I really need this, but can I use that? So that's one. The second is, in your investments, you absolutely must diversify.
Hmm.
Right? Don't put it all in one cryptocurrency and hope that's going to make your life. It could also ruin your life. So diversify your investments. You don't need to be in the safest stuff because you're young. You can take a few losses. But you need to be reasonably diversified because otherwise you're taking on too much risk in any one investment.
Is there a split people should follow between the risky and non-risky?
You know, if I mean, certainly, I think the having enough for your next year in the non-risky is a good idea.
Yeah.
To pay your rent, to pay your EMIs.
To cover your bills, yeah.
That's useful. And what you don't need for some time, put it in the riskier asset because then you have a chance of seeing it grow. Too many Indians I know have never invested in equity and that has served them poorly because the equity markets have done
really
so
well.
And the third, I think, is, you know, for financial security, ultimately what helps is a good job. And a good job comes if you constantly improve yourself. And the second thing that helps in a good job is keep challenging yourself. When your existing job, you're not learning anything more. Often it signals it's time to move on. Move to something else which is going to give you, you know, a fresh set of challenges.
Yeah.
You may feel uncomfortable. I mean, we always love comfort. I know everybody in this office. I know how to do my work. Everybody respects the work I do, but you're not growing.
Yeah.
And so keep challenging by keeping on moving and moving when you need to. I think that would...
That is more important than just moving haywirely.
Yeah, yeah. Move to look for new, better, more interesting experiences. I think all three are useful in my view.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you here. I wish I could speak to you for another 5 hours, but we don't have that much time. One day we'll have you again and probably I'll fly down to where you are and then we'll try to do this again. We'll dive deeper into the economy, Indian growth and a lot of stuff. I have a lot of ideas through my podcast. I would love to share them with you and then you can give your 2 cents and make us feel more enlightened as well.
Let's stay in touch. Thanks very much for having me. And it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you. Before we end this show, I want to thank each and every one of you. Because of you guys, we have come really far. Today, it's an honor that we have gotten one of the biggest economists in the world with us. Dr. Raghuram Rajan came here because of the constant support that you guys have shown us. I just want to say thank you. I don't have any ask today. I don't want you to share, like, subscribe, do anything. Just want to share my gratitude because the way you guys have supported us is more than enough. Thank you so much. I'll keep trying to bring these kind of episodes and try to get better and better guests for you so that you can become a better leader for this country. Until the next episode, keep figuring out.